Dean, how you doing, sir?
I'm really good. Had a few technical issues. This is the third computer I tried to get on today. So you got work.
You know, for all the technology that we all have, it's still just not always the easiest thing in the world
sometimes
to make happen.
The simple is just the best.
Exactly.
You try to plug in all this other stuff, and it's like, man.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. We missed last week. You were, I forget what we both had something going on, but I talked to the guys from a Christian Web3 community, which was pretty cool, called Reformers. Yeah. And they're really cool. They've started this whole community. They're starting like a Web3 product incubator, accelerator, and they may be doing they want to do their own podcast, I think, under the Vast banner.
They should come under the Vast network.
I think they're going to. Basically the idea is like, how should Christians and churches think about Web3 and all of that?
I mean, I think about it all the time. Like, you know, one of the main things that we solve is we move money, right? That's really at the core of our business. And up until 2 weeks ago, I thought stable coins were always going to be stable. It turns out
they're not.
But
I was going to have you explain to me that whole, what is a Terra coin situation that happened?
It's pegged to the US dollar, right? So the idea is I give you $100,000. Mm-hmm. You give me the same worth in these digital tokens. And I take that $100,000 and I put it in the bank somewhere and I never spend it. So it's like there's no, and what they do, there's an arbitrage overnight when you have, you know, mm-hmm. $30 billion in an account, you make money on the spread mm-hmm. of that dollar.
Can you explain to me arbitrage, like in like arbitrage for dummies?
Yeah, it's like micro cents on very large amounts of money being traded fairly quickly.
Okay.
And so you're just, there's this movement where you're trying to capture this tiny slither.
A tiny piece of the movement, right?
Yeah. It happens mostly in currency trading. And so... Yep. It's all to do with money movement, money transfer, that having a backup price, that having a buyer and a seller, and there's like this tiny, but because you're in the billions of dollars range, there's money mm-hmm. to be made in there.
Yeah.
So stable coins are just, you know, pegged against the currency, they're held, and then they're traded, and they're used to move money, right? This whole thing's mm-hmm. about moving money. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the tithe coin that I think about, right, people would give, it's held against a coin, and I could put money in the church bank account faster and cheaper than what I can do it for today. That's one use around Web3 that I've thought about.
Yeah. Okay. That's really cool. Yeah. I just kind of like asked him a bunch of questions, just like, help me understand this. What does this mean? It was really cool. So they're, you know, really four leaders in that space that I think are doing something really, really cool. So, you know,
it's going to be a thing.
Maybe here soon we'll have a weekly podcast on, you know, Web3 and crypto and how Christians should be thinking about it. So, I love it.
Uh-huh.
So I'm reading this book. I just started it, but you've heard of Tony Fadell, probably, right? Yeah. So the creator of the iPod, iPhone, Nest. Yep. I remember when Nest was first coming out, and he sort of came out and just talked about how like every product that we have to have, but that we hate the way it looks, I want to make it beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful.
And then I guess he sold his company to Google for a few $1 billion, but he just came out with this book, called Build, an unorthodox guide to making things worth making. And I'm literally probably just 20 pages into it, but, I'm stoked to reading it. Maybe we'll do an episode on it because it's really fascinating. The book's all over the place. And he kind of says that at the beginning, like, hey, this is not a streamline, you know, this is basically just 30 years of my riffs on what it means to build product, build companies, manage people. So,
sounds like if you want to be a product company, it'd be a good book to read.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So we're in a recession, we're nearing, I think the consensus is if we're not there yet, we will be.
Yep.
Is that right?
I agree. Well, absolutely. I think you just got to have two quarters, right? So Q1 was 1.5% mm-hmm. negative. So we'll see. If we're not, it's going to be real close. And and then it's going to happen. But it could be mild, right? So all kinds of things coming out from the Fed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We've got all this other kind of global impact. So things could change, you know? Mm-hmm. So wouldn't it be great? In some ways, and I think we said this, having a recession of some degree actually resets the table, clears a lot of the junk off through the system, gets rid of bad companies, bad operators, and then you're left with a better market that's in better shape, which is going to lead into what we're going to talk about today, about successful companies who started in, you know, down markets and recessions. But it literally just, all the pretenders go away, mm-hmm. most. And then you're left with the operators that know what they're doing. And
right.
Then that's the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have always heard people who are sort of on the other side of building successful companies. You know, sort of my first mentor in business started one of his businesses in 2008, 2009, and would always say, like, this only succeeded because we started in the middle of a recession, right? Like, you hear that. And for guys like me, it's always like, oh yeah, that sounds really great to be on the other side of it and having been successful and being like, now's a great time to to do it, you know? But I came across this article that, and I'm sure there's tons of companies, but here's, I think it's like 10 massive ones that started in a recession. So I figured we could literally walk through these just to give people an idea of like, hey, it's not really just a talking point that everyone's saying right now. It's actually a fact that recessions are great times to capitalize on opportunity.
And like, we'll go through some of these names in a minute, but I think the thing to think about is that if you have a business idea or a product idea and you are going to make it so good that people can't wait to get their hands on it, it doesn't matter if there's a recession.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a business owner, entrepreneur, you never want to have the mindset other than I'm going to win. And I am going to work out this problem that some market has, and I'm going to put something inside of that market that people are going to stampede for. And so it doesn't really matter what the economy is doing. What I'm building is going to be loved and wanted. Mm-hmm. And that's the attitude you've got to start with, no matter what's going on in the economy.
Right. Yeah, because if you're starting a business that is dependent upon a red hot economy to succeed, mm-hmm. that business is not going to last.
100%.
Yeah. It's interesting. I keep seeing all these takes about, and it is true. Like, you know, people my age, this is kind of our first time of seeing something like this and being of an age that's actually consequential, you know? So for so many of us, it's like a shock to the system. Like, what do you mean stuff doesn't grow every quarter in perpetuity?
This is the first time maybe a lot of entrepreneurs that got going in the last 10 years have ever seen a pullback. And we had 10, 11 years of unstoppable expansion and growth, mm-hmm. and top that with the free money that was all around.
Mm-hmm.
The party was going to end at some point and the music stops and, you know, there's always going to be a few people that don't get a chair to sit down. Mm-hmm. So they're out. Mm-hmm.
Did you see that movie? Did you ever watch that movie Margin Call? I watched it again recently the line where the guy talks about the music stopping. It's sort of like supposed to be Lehman Brothers the night before they basically accelerated the crash in 2008. Yeah. And I just recently watched it again and it's just like, it's so ominous. It's an ominous story. So it's crazy. I was looking at these companies and, you know, you think like, you sort of think about, and we'll get to some of them, you think, oh, like, of course, tech companies, very like futuristic, but there was actually just some very basic like goods and services companies that started in the middle of a recession. So there's a lot of opportunity. So do you want to walk through these?
Well, we got a couple of classics here, right, that everyone know, General Electric, General mm-hmm. Motors, IBM. So these are, you know, early 20th century. General Electric was like 1892, right?
Mm-hmm.
Edison gets the light bulb and turns mm-hmm. that into General Electric. And, you know, I don't know a lot about General Electric until Jack Welch took over, mm-hmm. but I really used to follow the company a lot when he ran it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was I read a lot of his stuff on business. He was brutal. Mm-hmm. We talked about Frank Slootman's book, you know, Amp It Up.
Yep.
And how like intense it is.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I was chatting with Frank the other day and like there's some people that just struggle with the intensity of constant growth and change. And expansion and more products and but you know, obviously I'm built like that. You look at a business book like, you know, Amp It Up, and then go back and read the old Jack Welch stuff. He's like, every year without fail, you will fire the worst 10% of performers. I don't care what's going on. Every division had to fire the worst, the lowest 10%. They just had to, just to clear it out. That's like full on, man. So, yeah. So, you know, you've got these companies that launched in tough times. It's kind of relevant, you know, launching a motor company in 1908, you know, William Durant here from General Motors went from buggies to acquiring Buick Company and building what GM is today. It's kind of interesting, though. You fast forward, you know, 110 years, and you know, Tesla stock, I think, is worth
down
every other car company
combined.
So, you know, just because you've been around 100 years doesn't mean you're going to stay around for another 100.
Yep.
And you've always got to be innovating. You've got to be looking around what's coming, what's next. Don't get too settled in, you know, what you, is the best and brightest idea in the marketplace, because the spirit of entrepreneurship is always around.
Yep.
And there's always someone coming for your product.
I love this about General Motors. It said that in the middle of the 30% business decline experienced during the 13-month panic of 1907, Durant decided to launch GM as a holding company to acquire even more automobile manufacturers. This strategy would serve GM well. So it wasn't even just like, how do I exist during this crazy time? It was literally, how do I grow or position myself for growth, right?
I wonder if he was the first, you know, house of brands strategy, rather than the thing about Ford, that was a branded house.
Right.
GM had all of those different products. Some of them are not around today. And they went the, you know, the many brands under one holding company structure, both work, it seems. And then it's fascinating to me that like IBM was launched in 1911. I'm like, what was even around?
Yeah. I didn't know that either. Yeah.
1911. But obviously, you know, they did a bunch of stuff, but I think the 50s when the big mainframes started getting produced and, you know, they're crunching data back then at speeds like today that, you know, would be eclipsed with like a half an iPhone. But, you know, and they went from kind of products to services, right? They used to make computers. And that's a fascinating transition on how they, in the era in the 80s and 90s where cheap computer components were being made, Michael Dell literally flying in stuff from China, putting computers together in his dorm and selling them to his college buddies, right? Like one of the best case studies ever of a business. And then, you know, really crushing IBM. And then you had your Compaqs and your, you know, Hewlett Packards and like, what was the one that had the cow logo on it? Like all these cheap computers, basically. And then IBM sells the Lenovo brand of computers to Chinese company. And literally like, well, what are they going to do now? Well, they did $77 billion in revenue, like on services. So it's a pretty cool way how you can reinvent, even if you're old and you're a one trick pony, but you see the winds of change. They come so fast, and they just reinvented themselves into a services company, literally going alongside this very enterprise level kind of sale and product, but going alongside the biggest companies in the world and helping them with their technology services, rather than building, you know, computer boxes and selling them for low margin.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we jump on to the next one, I want to ask you, so you mentioned sort of the house of brands versus branded house. Can we just talk maybe just quickly? Because I know that's come up in a lot of different industries recently. There's a lot of people in media talking about that right now, where you have these big media brands who are trying to figure out a way to, okay, if people are following people, not institutions, the whole idea is like flipping itself. So like when you talk about a house of brands versus a branded house, give me an explanation of like what we mean by that. Maybe using a car company as an example or something like that.
Yeah, car company, there's think about Intuit, right? That has QuickBooks and they just bought MailChimp. If you go to the MailChimp site now, they'll say MailChimp by Intuit. So the thing there is like There's a couple of reasons why you would do that. One, they're standalone products that don't integrate, but they have the same customer, which is usually why you would buy a product like that. They've got a really good brand that, you know, you shouldn't do away with. And you shouldn't change MailChimp's, you know, email newsletter machine.
Right.
Call it Intuit email.
Right.
So there's reasons around what the product does and who it serves. And if the brand is really good, like if it has a really high, you know, NPS score and it's loved and it's profitable, and all you want to do is actually add fuel to that fire so it can grow faster and serve its customers even better and expand the, you know, product feature line maybe inside the product. But, and so that's become more and more popular as just having one brand with divisions and it's all under the one brand. Both work. Both work across many industries. We just did the car industry, Ford versus GM. Right? And so I'm not an expert on this. I read a lot about it. I'm not an expert on it. And I think it's an individual case by case. If you're acquiring businesses, when you build technology, you have the ability just to have your brand and then just put all your products in it. If you're acquiring technology and you've got to think, man, I got to integrate that in, which is really hard, by the way. And I'm going to change the branding and bring it under my brand. That's hard. And we've actually kind of walked through that a little bit with what we've done. But in my estimation, I look at both work. Right. And I don't see an area, a world where one or the other is going to dominate.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So we talked to IBM, Disney. This was pretty cool that, 1929.
That was like the beginning of the end, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I just love this. It says, you know, the brothers knew that America needed a smile more than ever. And it's cool. I never knew this, that they started to work on their first full-length animated feature right after the Great Depression ended, which is like such a cool, it's such a cool like way of thinking, which kind of brought me to a question. And this is, again, very hypothetical, but I think, you know, COVID hits and every entrepreneur starts going, okay, what are people going to need, not just now, but coming out of COVID? Like is that kind of the same where, you know, we're now in this recession? Is it a time for people to be able to look at the world and go, what am I betting people are going to need 18 months from now? And how do I start building that now to hopefully, does that make sense?
Yeah. Look, you're looking to solve problems. That's what businesses start with. You're solving a problem. Are there going to be problems that appear in the next, you know, 12, 18-month economic slowdown? Not as bad as 08, 09, I don't believe, that global financial meltdown. I don't think it's going to be anything like that. I don't think it's going to be a 2000.com crash. I don't think it's going to be that either. The world is very different now. But it's going to stop growing, right? And growth is the mother's milk of all, you know, things wonderful for companies, just growth, growth, growth. So when you stop growing, or when the economy stops growing, and that's hurtful. But I don't think it's going to be a big one, number one. But if you're thinking about starting a business, the only thing that you need to think about is what problem I'm going to solve. And I was talking to someone yesterday, and they wanted to create something that was multifaceted. And I said, just go and solve one problem for this customer base, and you could build a $10 million business. And I just, because I could do the math in my head on how they could do it if I just did one thing really well. That's another conversation for another day. But it's like you're solving problems, you're fulfilling needs. And so when you turn up to a customer and say, here's this thing I built, and here's the three problems that just solved for you. By the way, it's so affordable, you can't not buy it. That's everything you need in a business to get cooking. And so it doesn't matter if it's the economy's good or it's not good. You're here to solve problems for people.
This may be an
In a recession.
Right? Yeah. So this may be an obvious question, but I think what you said made me really think about that is like, so let's like take Tidely, for example. So Tidely, someone could look at Tidely and go, okay, Tidely does two things. It makes it easier for churchgoers to give, right? So I think on the surface, it's like that could be the idea of like the problem Tidely is trying to solve is helping people give to their church easier. But really, your main customer in your mind is not the person giving. Your main customer is the pastor, right? So you're like, and that's this like small distinction, but it is that like drilling down into who is the customer and what am I providing? Because what you're consistently thinking about is not necessarily how do I make it easier for Michael Whittle sitting in his church to give? Although that's a result of what you're doing. You're saying, how do I help the pastor be resourced with the technology that's needed to help grow the ministry that they're building in all areas? Yeah. And that's a small distinction, but it's a distinction.
Well, it's a very important one though, right? So there's a few different kinds of companies. There's business to business, which is what we are. We make a product and sell it to a business. Business happens to be a nonprofit church, and you know, schools and other customers we have. B2C is direct to consumer, right? You know, I'm going to make my own brand of flip flops and I'm going to sell them on my Shopify website to consumers. That's B2C. And sometimes there's B2B2C, right? But yeah, you know, if you're going to sell something to a business, it's a business to business marketplace. So, you know, I don't have B2C frightens the, you know, everything out of me. I don't understand it. Consumer products. I don't think I'll ever get involved. I just, you know, I could learn about it, I guess. You can learn about anything, but that's not the thing I enjoy doing. I enjoy doing, you know, business to business, which is, you know, and both are lucrative.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So we had HP Hyatt, which that's pretty cool. I never knew that either. That they, you know, bought their first motel in near LAX, which is pretty crazy in 1958.
HP, right? That was the first, like buy the product, and then you're going to have to keep buying something from us for the rest of that product's life. So we're going to sell you this $200 printer, but you're going to buy $50 ink. Forever.
Yeah, right. And the printer, and the printer works, you know, the printer, the ink you need is only our branded
ink. Exactly. Yeah. And that eventually got hacked and people counterfeited it and you could do that. But, and you know, the paper, you know, industry, right? Like, and it's interesting, everything's still going digital. Man, I don't think paper usage is down for business. You still print, I still print a lot of stuff.
Same.
It's less, but.
Yeah.
But yeah, Hewlett Packard, you know, selling you printers and then ink for the rest of your life was a pretty good business model. And then, yeah, hotels, man. You know, like who'd have thought you could, in a downturn, like create a hotel and for people to come on vacation when they're not really spending. I don't know how these businesses were capitalized in their, you know, initial launch. If you got a ton of money behind you, you can get through any recession.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. And, you know, and you might have to spend it a bit more prudently and not just go bonkers, but
yeah. Hotels are fascinating. I had a neighbor who worked as a developer for Hotel Tonight and like the way that they were building their algorithms, like talk about capitalizing, like arbitrage, like they were in real time going out, scanning inventory, changing prices, changing the first hotel that popped up when you open the app. Like he started to explain it to me and I was like, man, there's so much that goes into even just like the daily pricing of a hotel room. It's such like an interesting thing. So cool. So Hyatt, Trader Joe's, which is pretty cool. Just a supermarket started in 1958, Pronto Markets in Southern California, which is really cool.
FedEx.
Yep.
Man, that guy is, there's tons of books on FedEx. You should find the best ones. I read a couple of them back in the day, but yeah, man, hit the famous, you know, thing there. He went to his professors at Yale and, you know, I got this idea and I'm going to like fly packages around the country. And they're like, you're a maniac.
And people will pay for it.
Yeah. And yeah. They did $65 billion in revenue last year.
Right. So right. Man, that's crazy. So where was I? Okay. I lost my spot.
Microsoft.
Okay. Microsoft. Yep.
The 70s, man, were like the worst decade on the planet as far as economics go, other than maybe 29 and early 30.
Yeah.
But it was just no growth, high inflation, high interest rates, like just brutalized. But hey, if you've got a product that is going to change the world literally, and you know, Microsoft did, But again, look at the morph, the way that company's morphed. It was selling software on disks back in the day. And then software went to the cloud. Microsoft mm-hmm. put their stuff in the cloud. But then again, they went to services as the big revenue driver now. Mm-hmm. And so, and they bought LinkedIn and they've done this other stuff. But just evolving, it's a great story mm-hmm. of a company adapting and evolving as technology and needs of people change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Electronic Arts, video game company. That's pretty crazy. I didn't realize they have 10,000 employees,
Yeah.
And then Salesforce, here's three huge ones, Salesforce, Google, and Facebook. And this says, okay, so though technically not started during recessions, these three giants were all launched right before major economic meltdowns. Google 1998, Salesforce 1999, and then right before the dot-com bubble burst, and then Facebook 2004, which is pretty crazy.
That's the best kind of example around all those companies that failed that were launched. Amazon, was pretty close behind there too.
Mm-hmm.
And then they experienced this massive downturn, like stocks went from $100 to $2. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, but if you've got a good product, a good team, some capital to get you through the dark times, man, you've got $1 trillion companies.
Mm-hmm.
I never forget. I was just right before the pandemic. I was in San Francisco. And for like a minute, it's about as long as I like to stay there.
yeah.
And I'm downtown and I'm at the bottom of these two towers and I look up and it says Salesforce.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that company like literally is 20 years old and like changed software forever. Kind of almost invented software as a service. And they've got these two ginormous, buildings. And then they had enough capital to go and buy a company like Slack for, billion or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
So just incredible.
Yeah. So, I think coming off this, it really is, now's a great time to start a business. Now's a great time if you've just started one. I keep hearing, I just keep hearing two people saying, to people that just started something, like now, if you can make it through this, that's a massive win for the future of what the business could look like. And I think so for all the doom and gloom.
Gone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So speaking of starting businesses, our last topic, and we'll just touch on this and maybe we talk about this a lot, this kind of stuff, but I think it's important to just keep hammering on. But someone sent in the question, okay, so I have an idea for a startup. How can I validate that it's a good idea? And how will I know when an idea is promising enough to commit to? Mm-hmm. So I have some stuff I kind of went around and found online, but I guess what do you think? How do you validate your business idea?
So it depends on the business, right? Product mm-hmm. or service, software or hardware. But the way I do it is I start talking to people,
mm-hmm.
right? And I will literally, if I have an idea, I will literally probably spend a year or two in sometimes overt like setup situations like, hey, Mike, I need an hour from you because I got to run this idea by you, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To, hey, we're playing poker and I'm like, hey, yep. I had this idea, Mike, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm kind of doing market research, mm-hmm. on ideas or something maybe that I want to do inside my current business, right? I want to mm-hmm. expand it.
Mm-hmm.
I asked James the other day, he's like, I said, James, I got this idea for this. He goes, that product that you guys have on, can you just make sure that works a bit better than it does today? It was really good though, because I'm like, sometimes you shouldn't be building new things when the old things are like running at 80% instead mm-hmm. of like 90%. Yeah. So yeah, that was kind of a good kick in the butt.
But that's great. You mentioned you mentioned James. And so like that being a customer, he's part of you have your customer base. You probably have a smaller customer base that you interact with. And then you have someone like James, who's an executive pastor of a church. Wow. And he's part of even a smaller group of people that I know you guys test product ideas with. And that's incredible. And the fact that, you have someone like James to just say that is awesome.
It is awesome. And we probably evolved in this in the last kind of year, especially 18 months, is, man, we are testing with customers more than we ever have.
Mm-hmm.
Because in our instance, we have you know, literally tens of thousands of churches. And if we get it wrong, like it, if something breaks, it can't break. It just can't, right?
Right.
If we launch a new, like a new giving product, it can't break. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that customer feedback is critical. But idea of validation, you're going to talk to a lot of people. You're going to, you know, you've got a market in mind, right? You've identified some kind of TAM. And so you're going to go to those people and you're going to go and, you know, give them coffee gift cards and get on a Zoom or knock on their door and say, hey, can I get 30 minutes here? And I want to validate this idea, how I'd like to solve this problem that I think you have in your business. So you just got to go do as much market research as you can. And then listen to it and be honest. Now, sometimes you might hear the answer and go, you know, no, I can build something that will actually do this. You know, as the guy that built Zoom, fascinating story. He worked for Cisco that had WebEx.
Right.
And at the time, there's Google, there's WebEx, there's Citrix. Like, there's two or three established players in this market.
Gosh, I remember the Citrix. I remember those days trying to get on a video call with some of that stuff. Oh, my gosh.
We got turned down by every VC. Mm-hmm. And so he did family and friends, took his 40-member team, because he went to WebEx guys. He says, we need to redo this. They're like, no, you're not. So he left, took his team, bootstrapped it, got some traction, and then literally got given like $30 million in a Series A, never spent it, didn't need to spend it because they were cash flow positive. And then COVID hit.
Dang.
Bang.
They exploded. Yeah. That's so crazy.
Just because someone says no, or just someone says, you know, I don't see a fit for this. Sometimes you got to kind of back your instinct and take the risk, right? Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, market research is huge.
Yeah, market research. And then, you know, a lot of the stuff I read was a lot of like, you got to get out of the idea phase and into like the most basic form of what the product could be. So you actually really do have something to test. And maybe that is even just like you said, this is my idea of what the product will do. But I need to talk to some people to make sure that they actually need it to do that, right?
Correct. And then so that's a viable product, right? MVP at some point.
This was one that I thought was really interesting, because I think that's the big thing is like I'm the type of person, I'm built to want to come up with this big idea, put all the proper pieces in place and launch big. Like I'm a marketer. That's the way that I think, right? So I always tend to want to do the whole thing at once and then make a massive splash. But I think what this is like, no, you just start taking little baby steps. You try stuff, you start working on stuff. Get early customer feedback before you go full on. So I love that. One thing I thought was cool is like, one thing that I read was inbound demand is a strong signal that you have product market fit. And the fact that you can get inbound demand even on this like little basic MVP, that's pretty crazy. And
that's like, if you can discover that, and like, quite honestly, that's the secret sauce of, you know, our company. There was such a demand and all we had to do is buy some keywords on Google, like mobile giving, text giving, church giving, giving on phone. Like we just bought all those and we're still today all inbound sales. Only outbound is me or, you know, one of Frank or somebody like networking with big churches at a golf event or something.
You don't have a sales room of people making cold calls trying to, you know, get the product in people's hands, right?
We had competitors who did that, and I don't think it helped their brand, and they went for a segment of the market that is now saturated, and we went the opposite direction, and you know, we still have plenty of business,
plenty of opportunity. So. Okay, so lastly, and I think we can dig into this even more, but I think this is two that are really good. So seek out both functional and emotional needs from your users, right? To make sure you're building something that's a must have, not a nice to have, which means you got to really dig for the deep needs, which is, I think that's exactly that example you just gave of James. It's like, hey, this idea is really cool. And he's sort of like, yeah, but this thing
that you already built, I want it to work better.
So maybe like, I guess just that must have versus nice to have. What's an example of a must have versus nice to have that you can think of?
I think we're probably going to have to go to a kind of part two of this, because mm-hmm. there's a lot to unpack here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's going to come down to you as the business entrepreneur doing, like, really understanding the problem. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the advantages I had is I had 30 years of understanding the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem was you had to be in church to give. Mm-hmm. That was the problem. Mm-hmm. And I had 30 years of experience around that. And so when Bond built the first app, and looking back on it, man, it's like, I think it was rinky dink, mm-hmm. But it solved the problem. Mm-hmm. And it kind of didn't work half the time. It would time out. It would, like, there's all these things wrong with it. But I just got it into the market and tested it and discovered that the problem that I knew and I expertly knew was a problem for a lot of other people as well. Mm-hmm. And so I just think you've got to be so intricately understanding of the problem that you know what you have to build first, mm-hmm. and what you have to do first. And then I'm the opposite. I get things in market, and if, mm-hmm. if they break, and if they're, I gotta, like, I would rather grow as I do and mm-hmm. learn as I go than sit in the back room for 3 years, build it all, and pop it out to the marketplace. And you got,
and then they're not into it. Yeah.
And meanwhile, yeah. there's 14 competitors that spent that 3 years going to market, mm-hmm. and now you're behind. Now half the market's gone, and you're playing catch up. And
yeah,
I never think that's the best way to go.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Yeah, maybe we'll do the next episode. I love that idea of the problem and must have, mm-hmm. building something that's a must have and not a nice to have. Maybe we'll dive into that on the next episode, because I think that's a massive way to think about building products, especially now. So cool. Dean,
awesome, man.
As usual, man, thank you. If you're listening and you got any questions, hit us up on Instagram, Twitter. Our sort of new website is up, vast.faith. You can reach out to us there, sign up for the newsletter. Yeah, slowly making progress. I'm learning how to make websites one day at a time.
Amen. Everyone's got to, even I can do it.
Exactly. Awesome. Cool. Well, reach out to us if you're listening. We'd love to hear from you, love to answer your questions, and we will see you next week.
Awesome. Blessings. See ya.
See ya.